Way to go, Avery. Yeah. Good. She's got a good chance to teach people just by about how to live God's way, just by her example. So that's great. All right. Well, as you know, we had a youth lesson today, and they're covering the second commandment. And so I thought I would cover that as well. And then Matthew suggested you do the same thing, so that's good. So what I'd like to do today is cover the second commandment, not just a repeat of what's with the kids, but hopefully a little more substance to it. So let's take a look as we start here. I've entitled the sermon, What Are Your Priorities? What are your priorities? So first let's go to Matthew 19, Matthew the 19th chapter. And just by way of introduction, Matthew 19, and we'll look here at verse 17. He says, so he said to them, why do you call me good? There's no one good but one, that is God. But if you want to enter into life, keep the commandments. And so we know that. We know, which ones? Well, the Ten Commandments. So we want to start doing that today and want to build upon it. So, and I know that as we would, if we were to go into all of your homes, you don't have these little idols built into your closet somewhere and you light the candles to it. So you think, well, why do we need to know about the second commandment? Well, because there's one application of it, which is more like, the physical side, and we'll talk about that you saw in the Old Testament. But there was also a spiritual side, even in the Old Testament, obviously, but even more for us here today. So, now, you know, I was kind of kidding about you don't see, statues and things like that in our homes. Well, we don't in our homes, but I visited people who had those in their homes, and they thought they were ready to start coming to church. And I think I've mentioned this to you before. It happened to me right around Christmas time, so went on this visit, first time visit, and they had their little Christmas tree up, and then they had a little statue of Mary and the candles and a place to kneel, and you. The idea is you would light the candle and you say your rosary or whatever prayer it is you want to say. And as long as that candle is burning, the prayer goes up to that patron saint and so forth, who then prays for you. And again, and I thought, wow, this must be a pretty new person. Then we walked into his office, and there were probably 15 years, I don't think I'm exaggerating, 15 years of good news and magazines, Plain Truth magazines. I don't think he's getting it. and you know, he just couldn't deny his children that. And so, it's interesting where God says, be sure to go out of your way to teach your children not to do that. And yet, people just don't get it. So anyway, so, you know, sometimes we do run into things like that. But for us, we don't, you know, I don't, worry about you go over to your house and you will see some kind of idol and this, that, and the other thing. No. So why do we need to discuss this? Well, that's what we'll be talking about here today. Let's go to Exodus 20. Exodus, the 20th chapter. Because at first glance, when we read some of these things, there seems to be inconsistencies. And again, I say seems. We just need to look through it and understand a few basic points here. Exodus, the 20th chapter. And this, of course, is the chapter where you see the Ten Commandments. And we're not going to go to Deuteronomy 5, but Deuteronomy 5 is sort of a mirror image of Exodus 20, except there are a few little differences in the wording, and more than anything, different in emphasis. So, okay, so now we're in Exodus, the 20th chapter, and let's just pick it up in verse 1. And God said all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, this is the first commandment, out of the house of bondage, he's introducing himself, you shall have no other gods before me. So I'm the one true God, and you just come out of this incredibly pagan system, and they worshiped everything that moved, literally. They worshiped everything that moved. So he says, you shall have no other gods before me. And then, picking up here in verse 4, he's now going to expand this concept for them to understand. You shall not make for yourself any carved, or in the old King James, it's graven image or carved image. They would carve these things out, and they would put them up. Remember we talked last time about Laban had these idols, these family idols. That's what they do. They would carve them out, and they would keep them. Now, these, they had religious, plus they also had economic importance to them. We talked about that last time, where you, the wealth of the family would be identified with these certain types of idols, not all idols, but certain types of them. You shall know the gods before me, then verse 4, you shall not make for yourself any carved or graven image or any likeness of anything that is in the heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them nor serve them, for I am the Lord your God, I'm a jealous God. Or again, he insists, the Hebrew word shows, I'm red-faced for you, sort of, I'm emotionally involved with you. I love you and I care for you. I want the best for you. The word jealous there, we have these negative connotations for jealous. But here he's saying, I'm jealous. Another way you might say, I'm zealous for you. I care for you. This isn't a perfect analogy, but maybe it'd help. You know, sometimes when God, would be, angry with ancient Israel, you can almost see, you know, his face kind of getting red, like, what are you doing that for? You know, you're here, you're making these images and worshiping before these pagan deities. I'm jealous for you. I don't want you to get into those relationships. So anyway, that's kind of how that is. It's not a mental illness that he's jealous. Okay, so we talked a little bit about that last time, but so I don't want to go there too much. So it says, don't make any graven image. Don't make any carved image. Because God is really cares for us. Now, what does that mean then? Does that mean that we have children that they shouldn't have dolls? It's a graven image. I mean, it's made. It's something made on the earth that depicts something. Is it wrong to have a picture or a photograph of maybe a big marlin that you catch when you're out fishing? I've never done that. Would be neat. Is it wrong? That's an image. Well, no, that's not wrong. Okay, but it says don't make any image of anything. But let's stop and go back and look at this part of the verse here so we can begin to catch a little better view of this. Verse 4, you shall not make for yourself any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in the heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the waters under the earth. We want to put a little emphasis here on verse 5. You shall not bow down to them, nor serve them. He's talking here about a matter of focus, a matter of emphasis. If your child or whatever has a doll or you have a picture of a fish that you caught, you're not putting your focus on that image to worship a deity. But he says, now when you don't make any kind of an image of anything above the earth, beneath the earth, don't do that. And then put your focus on that image and part of your worship ceremony. Don't do that. So we'll get to that. I want to talk here about focus. What is our focus? In this case, it's religious focus, so that people would put their focus and their energies into this worship. Now let's go to Exodus 25, because at first glance it looks like this is a contradiction. If you're not supposed to make anything above the earth and below the earth, and we talked about focus, but what about Exodus 25? And let's pick it up here in verse 18. He's describing what needs to be built into the temple, or even in this case, into the tabernacle. They'd have the tabernacle in the wilderness. Later on, they would have the temple. Okay, so this is now for the tabernacle in the wilderness. So we'll pick it up here. Is it warm, or is it just me that's warm? Any more deeply converted people say it's warm? Don't let me pressure you. Okay. Verse 17, you shall make a mercy seat of pure gold. Wow. Remember, you asked to cut off, take off your earrings and your, sounds weird, your nose rings and all those other rings. And then they would melt them down. And they, most of the time they took those items from the Egyptians. Remember, they spoiled them and they were coming back. And now God is saying to do this. Wait a minute. I thought I wasn't supposed to make any kind of image. See? You shall make a mercy seat. You remember the mercy seat here of gold and have 2.5 cubits, and it gives its length and its width and so forth. Verse 18, and you shall make 2 cherubim of gold of hammered work. Hammered, that's like a graven image, isn't it? Now, is this contradictory? Well, no. But we'll get into that as we go through here. Now, many critics of the Bible say, ask, this is a contradiction, so why bother with the Bible kind of thing? And you shall make 2 cherubim, verse 18, of gold, of hammered work, you shall make them at the 2 ends of the mercy seat. So you've seen the 2 angels over the mercy seat, and their wings are over it. There are ones on one side here, and ones on this side, and their wings are covering over. In fact, Lucifer was one of those at one time. And it, after his rebellion, of course, then he wasn't there. So he was one of those covering cherubs, it says. And when they would build, and God instructs that this be built, well, why? I thought we weren't supposed to have any graven images and this type of thing when we are worshiping God. Well, let's take a little bit more. Verse 19, and one at one end, one on the other, on that mercy seat that we talked about, at the 2 ends, one piece, cherubim at the 2 ends of it, one piece with the mercy seat. In other words, it's all one piece here. And the cherubim shall stretch out their wings above the covering seat. All right, so why is this allowed when just a few minutes earlier from our time in reading, but a few days later, earlier, God says, don't do that. Now, what is happening here? And there's a lot more we could read, but for time's sake, I think hopefully you get the point here. Let's go now to Hebrews 9. Let's kind of take a look at Hebrews 9. Now, Hebrews is written by somebody who was a Hebrew, who knew the traditions and the customs, and whoever the author is, we don't know for sure. A lot of speculation, it doesn't really matter. But let's go to Hebrews, the 9th chapter. All right, Hebrews, the 9th chapter. Says, verse 1, then indeed even the first covenant, so that would be the old covenant, had ordinances, they had statutes, they had instructions of how to do things, and a divine service and an earthly sanctuary. For the tabernacle was prepared, the first part of it was with lampstand, so it gives us a quick overview. There's a lampstand, a table, the table, of the showbread, which is called the sanctuary. And behind the second veil, a part of the tabernacle, which is called the holiest of all, or the holy of holies. So there was a curtain, and there was other things inside there. And but why would God have that? Which had the golden altar, verse 4, of incense, and the ark of the covenant overlaid on all sides with gold, on which were the golden pot, and which had the manna. So there was even, wouldn't that be awesome? To be able to see the original manna that God has given Israel for 40 years and be on the ground every morning, but God would preserve it through a miracle inside that ark. Of course, if you really want to know what that looks like now, what you do is you got to go to Washington, D.C. and go down into a basement. I don't know where that is, but it's huge and it's got boxes everywhere. Just watch Raiders of the Lost Ark. You'll get all the answers there.
Okay.
Sorry about that. It's red. Did I just do something bad? Okay. Hello. All right. See, I gave the secret where it was at. Now I'm in trouble. Okay. So, 9 verse, now let's take chapter 9 verse 3 now. And behind the second veil was the Holy of Holies, verse 4, which is the golden altar. We already read that. Verse 5. And above it were the cherubim, the glory overshadowing the mercy seat. Of these things, we cannot now speak in detail.
Okay, but why was it in there? Were these objects of worship, or were they something else? And I propose to you that they're not objects of worship, but they did something very important. First of all, most of these objects the people never saw anyway. The priest would see them. And what was the importance of that? Well, let's take a look at chapter 8 of Hebrews, verse 1. Now, this is the main point of the things which we are saying. We have such a high priest. So Christ is our high priest now. In the Old Testament, they had a high priest. So the physical high priest in the Old Testament represented who would become the high priest in our time. Okay? Who seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty of heaven. So what you're seeing, okay, well, we'll read it and we'll tell you. A minister of the sanctuary of the true tabernacle which the Lord erected and not man. The tabernacle that God instructed them to make, especially the one in the wilderness and so forth, God instructed them to make, and he wanted them to know, this is what it looks like in heaven. You're going to make it with hands, forming it with gold and so forth, and hammering that out. And it's not that you worship those images. That's not the point of them at all. They're not the focus at all. But to understand that in heaven, there is this active throne room. There's an active life, if you will, going on in the throne room. There's the high priest, and then we get other things from Daniel and so forth as well. But all this is going on, and they represent what is in God's throne room. They're not objects of worship that God intended them to worship. So when we hear about the mercy seat, we don't have a copy of it on earth and we say, or a picture of it, and we want to, you know, pray to that because it just sort of helps us stay in contact. No. You know, I love to get these little models and look at it so I can kind of get an idea of what it looks like. And even then, we're not always sure about every little detail. But it represents what is in heaven, which was erected not by man, as it says in verse 2. A minister of the sanctuary and of the true tabernacle, which the Lord erected and not man. For every high priest is appointed to offer both gifts and sacrifices. Therefore, it is necessary that this one, the true high priest, that we know today as Jesus Christ, and there was a physical man serving that role in the Old Testament to help us understand what's going on in heaven, especially now. It's necessary that this one also has something to offer. And then the point is, this high priest offered himself the ultimate service, the sacrifice. For if he were on earth, he would not be a priest, since there are priests who offer the gifts according to the law. They are of Levi. Jesus was not a Levite. But in the Old Testament, it would be of the Levites. But Jesus was of Judah. This is really the point he's making. But anyway, the point is there's a copy here on earth of what is on in heaven, so you can better understand the dynamics that's going on. Not that we focus and worship on that. So if I go to your house and you have a little tabernacle of meeting in your home and there's candles, we'll get a problem. See. But, you know, I enjoy, I know some of the ministers in the past have done like their dissertations and so forth on the temple and how it was built. And it's interesting. Then later on I talked to one, he says, yeah, well, I was wrong here, I was wrong here. That's okay. They're doing the best they can to try and figure out how it was and how it was set up and, you know, what was done. Okay. He would not be a priest, verse 4, since there are priests who offer the gifts according to the law, who serve a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. So it's a copy, it's a shadow of the heavenly things, so they could better understand what God is doing. And so, remember now, we get this understanding when Christ died and he offered himself up to the Father. It's like the wave sheaf offering. Oh, okay. And the priest would go in and sprinkle the blood on atonement. And then Jesus, the scriptures say, he went once and offered himself up once for all. So when we see that analogy, we don't worship what is mentioned here in the Old Testament. We understand it's a copy of what God is doing in the New Testament. As we heard already, it helps us to be more thankful and more appreciative of what's going on. But we don't worship those things. See? We don't worship those things. They are not our focus. The focus is really what's going on in heaven and so forth. All right. Now let's go to, let me just pick up verse 5. Who served the copy of the shadow of the heavenly things as Moses was divinely instructed when he was about to make the tabernacle. For he said, see that you make all things according to the pattern shown you on the mountain. So God gave him the vision of what it was supposed to look like. But now he has obtained a more excellent ministry inasmuch as he is a mediator of a better covenant which was established on better promises. There was national promises in the Old Testament, but now there's these promises because of this high priest, Jesus Christ, died, resurrected, fulfilled with so much of those things that was pictured in the Old Testament and the things that would go on in the heavenly of heavens, the Holy of Holies and so forth. Boy, these are better promises. These are the better promises. Alright. So it's a matter of focus. What is our religious focus? It's a matter of worship. That's why, I know there's some places, I won't say where, but we rent a building, as we do most of the time, and they have this humongous cross behind you. Well, we don't want to do that. That's what we're talking about here. That's not our focus. So they spend some money and just cover it. And then when service is over, they pull down the flag and there it is again. So, we don't make a big deal of it because that isn't really our focus, but it's kind of a little bit disconcerting to see that. All right, let's go to Daniel 3 now. And let's just see another example of what is focus. What is focus here? What is our focus? And then I want to ask you, okay, so we don't do these kind of things. We don't have these images there. So what is it that we can take away from this message? Well, we'll get into that in just a minute. Let's go to Daniel 2. Okay, Daniel 2. And let's start in verse 31. I will have to go quickly over this. You can go back and look at it yourself. So Daniel and his two other friends or other captives are there. The Babylonians and many people in the ancient cultures, one way in which, and I think I've told you this probably several times and you're probably yawning by now, but when you defeated a people, you wanted to go and gather the elite, if you will, the smart, in some cases well-educated people, and bring them in and make them, educate them into your culture. In other words, you'll be the Babylonian. You want to bring in these Jews, bring them in and make Babylonians out of them. That's why I'd even give them names that were Babylonian names. And they were young men who would be able to absorb the teaching of the of Nebuchadnezzar and his, of the Babylonians. And the whole idea again, this was, they didn't just do it for the Jews, but they did it for everybody they would capture, everybody they would conquer. Because they wanted to understand the way these people thought, what their gods were, how did you keep their gods happy? Because the whole idea was, especially with the Babylonians, in order to have peace in this empire, which is a huge empire, the only one closer to it was the Romans, and they were even bigger. In order to make sure that you had peace with this vast empire, with all these gods that everybody worshiped, there are different ones this, different one here, and how you do? Well, you get these people in who are the sort of the elite of the people you conquered. You educate them into your culture, you're talking to them, and then they are learning about your gods. And there's this back and forth going on. And in most cases in these different cultures, they didn't care if they added a few dozen more gods to their, what's the word I'm looking for? Anyway, pantheon. To their little pantheon, they didn't care. But the Jews, they had this one god idea and everything. And so it was hard for the Babylonians to understand that. But the Babylonians wanted to keep the gods happy. And everybody they conquer has these gods. They got to try to keep them happy. So, tell us about your God. They talked to Abraham, Daniel, Meshach, and Abednego. They talked to him. Okay, what are you going to do? Okay, Now, we don't eat the meat that you guys eat. Huh? Okay, so then you know that story and how it went. And all of this was to understand the gods of the conquered people so that you could have peace in the empire. So if you have peace in the empire, then you can go destroy some more people and take them over and do the whole process over again. So it's weird, but that's how it works. All right. So Nebuchadnezzar has this weird dream, and it frightens him. So he tells his soothsayers, well, I want to know, one, what the dream was. I'm not going to tell you. Two, you have to interpret it. Well, they can't do that. He says, look, I know what you're going to do. I'm going to tell you the dream. You're going to, just do anything and say anything to make me feel good. And he says, I'm really troubled about this dream. So he says, you don't know by morning, you're all dead. I mean, everybody, including Daniel and the others that were with him. So word got around. Daniel came and said, I got to do this fast. Daniel said, let me go and talk to God and I'll come back and he'll give you the answer. All right, so let's listen here, verse 24 of Daniel 2. Therefore, Daniel went to Arioch, who the king appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. So he says, if these guys don't come up with the answer, kill them all. Okay, now, Daniel's union is not very strong at this point. That's a bad joke. Okay. He went and said thus to him, do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me before the king, and I will tell the king the interpretation. This man is already going out to kill them. Okay, this is not a good way to start the night. Okay. Then Arioch quickly brought Daniel before the king and said, thus to him, I have found a man who, of the captives of Judah who will make known to the king the interpretation. The king answered and said, Daniel, whose name was Belshazzar. Remember now he gave him a Babylonian name because he's going to acculturize all of these young men into the Babylonian system. Are you able to make known to me the dream which I have seen and its interpretation? Daniel said in the presence of the king and said, the secret of the king has been, the king has demanded the wise men and the astrologers and the musicians, all of these soothsayer types, and the soothsayers cannot declare to the king. But there is a God in heaven. He didn't say, no, I can do it. Yeah, I'm pretty sharp. No. He says, no, but there is a God in heaven who reveals the secrets, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Now, he'd already understood the dream now. Again, you know the story. So now he begins to tell. Now, the king had not told him the dream. He just said, I had a dream. Tell me what it is and interpret it. No one could do that. Your dream and the visions of your head upon your bed were these. Says, as for you, O king, thoughts came into your mind while on your bed about what would come to pass after this, and he who reveals secrets has made known to you what will be. But as for me, this secret has not been revealed to me because I have more wisdom than anyone living, but for our sakes who make known the interpretation to the king, and that you know the thoughts, that you may know the thoughts of your heart. Okay, I know I'm going fast, but you should be familiar with this. You, O king, were watching, and a great image of whose splendor was excellent stood before you, and its form was awesome. The image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, and its belly and thighs of bronze, and all, because you know this. I'm not trying to go in to interpret these things. Just about any Bible commentary will correctly interpret these things, because they studied history and it falls right in line about these various empires. Now, verse 36. This is the dream. Now I will tell you the interpretation there. You, O king, are the King of Kings. That's a title for Christ, isn't it? The King of Kings, Lord of Lords. Well, he's saying this. You're the King of Kings. You're the one king over all the known world. You, king, are the King of Kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory. Now, he didn't say, your army's dead. He says, the God that I worship that revealed all this to me, he gave you this. Okay? And whenever the children of men dwell, and the beasts of the field and the birds of heaven, he has given into your hand, and you made ruler over them, and you are this head of gold.
And you know, imagine this, his head's got to be just swelling. He couldn't wear a hat. Yeah, I'm the man, I'm bad. You know, I could have seen him doing it if he was in our day. Then he talks about after you there'll be other empires. And so you know all that. I'm not going to get into all that. So what happens? Well, he's very thankful. He's really moved it. Boy, Daniel knew the truth. He says, Daniel, you're number three in the empire. You're the man. Nobody better say anything bad about you or, you know, you're going to have a bad day. So, okay. So, verse 48 of this chapter. Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylonia and chief administrator over all the wise men. So he was all the wise men and the boss over them. Also, David petitioned the king and set his other friends, and they got offices as well. Now, so Nebuchadnezzar did that. He was moved. But when you're Nebuchadnezzar, you're the leader, and you've grown up knowing that you're thinking anyway that you're a god and you're with it, you know. And then here's this Jewish guy. He said, his God put me over all the kingdoms of the world. And he's looking in the mirror and he's thinking, I'm not too bad. Nebuchadnezzar, verse 1 of chapter 3. The king made an image of gold. Remember, it said the head was gold and there was silver and bronze and all. He makes this image like 90 feet tall, if I remember right. And it's solid gold. And he's saying, that's me. Okay? And you know the story. Then God punishes him. Now, the point of all that was to show you that when Nebuchadnezzar changed the focus of what he was supposed to learn, God says, you should learn that I'm the one, and I'm telling you through Daniel, I'm the one who moves and brings nations, that raise kings and remove kings. You know, they rise and fall on God's command, on God's instruction. Now, you don't see that. You know, people do this, people do that. But anyway, God's the one working in history behind the scenes. Just little things you might, we know we've talked about it before in the past, but there's some very good books about how God has intervened and protected, you know, the United States and other countries, especially the British Israelitish people. Just a real quick story. I think I may have told you this, but can't help it. During World War I, the British were engaged in a big fight with the Germans, and they were just onslaught of Germans coming. They had a lot of trench warfare in those days. It's a terrible bloody mess, and the Germans kept coming, and finally the British were out of, they didn't have any more bullets, and they knew the next wave they were going to be overrun, so they just kind of standing there. They're not going to go up and say, hey, we don't have any bullets left. And they could see the Germans massing and getting in there, but we're done, you know, we can't do anything. And all of a sudden, the Germans turned and just ran the opposite direction in absolute fear. So the British commander said, go after him and catch him. So, you know, they did. They wanted to capture him, and so they did. And these were Prussian soldiers. These people are tough, you know. And then, if you look into German history a little bit, that's the warring class of people is in there, the Prussians. So they were interrogating these guys, trying to figure out what happened. And these guys are scared. They were terrified. And so the British were saying, you know, tell me, mate, you know, what happened, old chap? They're terrible at that. Okay. Brian's good at it, but I'm lousy at it. You know, what happened? And he said, didn't you see them? No. Remember, it's World War I. He says, all those guys on those white horses and their white uniforms, they saw angelic beings. And for whatever reason, God decided to protect those guys. I don't know. We'll ask him later. But these guys were petrified. Okay? Well, even Old Testament says, you know, 5 of you will run, 10 of you will run off 100. You know, if they would obey him. So anyway, here we go. So we see the story. What is the focus of worship here in chapter 1, chapter 3, and verse 1 here in Daniel? Is that Nebuchadnezzar's sin was He wanted everybody to bow down and worship him, whatever the music would be played, right? But I bring up this matter of focus. What is our focus in our lives? And we sort of heard about that in the first sermon here today. What is our focus? Is there something that comes before God? It may not, it's not going to be some little idol. Maybe it's a job that you wouldn't give up for anything in the world. Not that jobs are wrong. There's nothing wrong with a job. But it can become a false god. Especially young guys, they get a car, they worship at the altar of polishing it day after day. They care until they got it for 6 months and they don't care. But, you know, what is it that's taking up your time, taking you away from Bible study? Is it television? Is it whatever? What is it that's taking you away from God? These are the things that we need to ask ourselves. What is our focus? What is our focus in life? Is it we want to serve God first? Or is there always something else that we need to do this, then we'll do the Bible study. Then we're going to do that, then I'll have time to pray. We've all done it. But what is the proper focus of our attention? And when you think of those words, I am the Lord your God, you shall have no other gods before me. How do we make sure that happens? You don't put anything other than me as your first focus. What does it say in Luke? Anyone who, let's go there to Luke and we'll wrap it up there. Gospel of Luke. I think it's chapter 12. Okay, let's look at verse 22 of Luke 12. And he said to his disciples, therefore I say to you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat, what's your focus, about your body, about what you will put on. Life is more than food, and the body is more than clothing. Consider the ravens of the, for they neither sow nor reap, which are neither in the storehouse nor barn, and God feeds them. How much more value are you than the birds? And don't worry about, and which of you by worrying can add one cubit to his stature? When we learn that, and as we learn that by little stages in our lives, we get more and more peace. Because you see, then you're not worshiping false gods. And by that I mean our focus. What is our focus? They say, like, worry is negative faith. I've heard that. That's a pretty good way to put it. If you then are not able to do the least, why are you anxious for the rest? And he talks about all these things. And then he talks about which man goes to war and if he doesn't count the cost first. All of these things is what he's talking about. What is our focus? What is our focus? So, in conclusion, let me just say this. What is the focus of our life? Seek you first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these other things will be added to you. And for you is probably a better way of putting it. And we want to make sure we keep that focus, that God is our focus. That is what we want to make sure we keep that one thing in mind. I am the Lord your God. You shall not have any other gods before me. And don't lose that focus. That's really what second commandment is. I'm just paraphrasing. And don't lose focus. Don't lose focus as we learn more how to worship the true God.